I'm Julie Davis, president of City Club, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to this evening's program. Before we get started, I want to remind most of us in North America that we live on stolen land. Here in the Portland region, this is the territory of the Multnomah, Catlamet, and Clackamas, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and Malala, the Wasco, Cowlitz, and many other indigenous people who have known the Columbia and Willamette Rivers as their home for thousands of years. Together, we recognize their unbreakable connection to this land, and we honor the resilience of their ancestors and the hope of future generations. Today's debate is between Mary Nolan and Chris Smith, two candidates running for the District 5 seat on the Metro Council. District 5 represents Northwest, North, and Northeast Portland. Before we get started, I want to thank Leslie Johnson, Samantha Ritterbush, and Jill Gibson for producing tonight's debate, and the entire program team for working so hard to make this evening's event possible. More than 100 years ago, City Club hosted its first debate. While a lot has changed since then, City Club continues to be an independent, nonpartisan organization committed to providing a space for people to gather and participate in lively conversations about the critical issues confronting our communities. Even today, as COVID-19 challenges our social norms, City Club continues to work towards more open and inclusive public spaces. City Club has been sustained all these years through the generous support of our members, donors, foundations, nonprofits, and businesses, small and large. Today, we are grateful for the collective support from all of our members and donors. You are what makes it possible for City Club to host our fall season of forums and debates. I also want to take a moment to recognize our season sponsors, Northwest Natural and Chevron, and acknowledge our partners, Morel Inc., Merge Design, Pamplin Media, and X-Ray FM. We appreciate your shared commitment to helping Oregon voters get informed. It's now my pleasure to welcome Dana Haynes, managing editor at the Pamplin Media Group, which includes the Portland Tribune. Dana is our moderator for tonight's debate.
Welcome to City Club's Metro District 5 debate with Chris Smith and Mary Nolan. Metro is unique. I'm a newspaper editor, and I picked that word with precision, unique. There is not another agency in America with quite the same depth and breadth of responsibilities. It is the quiet giant of regional governance. And if I was to ask everyone who lives on my block what they think of Metro, my guess is 90% of them would not have heard of it. That's why this debate is so important. We have about an hour, and I know everyone's eager to hear from the candidates, so let me quickly outline how we're going to run through this debate. To get us started, each candidate will have 2 minutes for an opening statement. Once the statements are concluded, we'll move on to the Portland Tribune's questions for the candidates. Once the moderated questions have concluded, the candidates will each ask one prepared question to their opponent. From there, we'll move to the audience questions. One wrinkle we've added to debates this fall is what we're calling a free speech pass. If the candidate would like to rebut a point made by his or her opponent, extend their own answer time, or clarify a response, the candidate simply needs to raise the free speech pass. Each candidate has two passes, and each is worth 30 seconds each. Finally, we'll close the debate with a two-minute statement from each candidate. Now, a little bit earlier, we flipped a coin to determine who would be giving their opening remarks first. Mary Nolan won the toss. Mary Nolan, please begin.
Thanks, Dana, and thanks to City Club for hosting this. I am glad that people will have an opportunity to get more familiar with what Metro Council is responsible for and how it can make a difference for the good in people's lives. Portland is a liberal community, meaning certainly to the left on the political spectrum, and also marked by generosity and broad-minded. In all three aspects of liberal, I am perfectly aligned with the residents and voters of District 5. My advocacy and leadership for generous policies and programs spans Metro's authority and Portland values. Creating and expanding green spaces at the city and statewide, creating a vastly popular, effective Portland Recycling Program, and expanding the statewide bottle bill. Overhauling the entire statewide land use system to match environmental imperatives with neighborhood accessibility and equitable economic growth. innovative transportation policies to move away from fossil fuels and reduce greenhouse gases. A new funding mechanism for the state that tripled affordable housing investments. And that's just my warm-up act. I am known as a convener, a problem solver, a collaborator. That's the broad-minded aspect of my liberal. I work with people from all viewpoints, all life experiences, all religions. My core values remain firm, but I am also humble enough to know and admit when I erred or evolved with new information. Sam Chase admirably and effectively represented District 5 with this same approach for 8 years. I aim to carry on that success.
Chris Smith.
Thank you, Dana. Thank you for this forum. As a longtime member of City Club, I'm grateful for your ability to continue hosting these forums through these difficult times. My name is Chris Smith, and I'm running a grassroots campaign for Metro Council. Metro is uniquely positioned to tackle initiatives for climate action, affordable housing, and racial justice, where our state and federal governments have fallen short. And to paraphrase Metro Council President David Bragdon in his endorsement of my campaign, I believe I'm uniquely qualified for this position. I'm not a career politician. I haven't spent years in Salem navigating the political parties and the special interests that dominate our sclerotic, broken politics. Instead, I've spent the last 2 decades learning the intricacies of land use and transportation policy that make up the heart of Metro's work, and crafting solutions to reduce our city's carbon footprint, to tackle racial inequalities, and to chip away at the affordable housing crisis. I can point to numerous examples of policy victories and successes for climate justice from my time on the Planning and Sustainability Commission. I believe that the combination of policy acumen, empowering frontline communities, and moral clarity on the threat that fossil fuel infrastructure represents are all key qualifiers for service at Metro. I'm running a grassroots campaign. Voters won't have to wonder whether my decisions are influenced by thousands of dollars in donations from real estate interests or people who want to expand freeways. My track record demonstrates that I've been showing up in these spaces for years and demanding that local and regional governments take our overlapping housing, transportation, climate, and racial justice conversations seriously. Metro needs brave, independent, and unapologetically bold leadership to tackle our region's challenges. That's why I'm running for Metro Council. I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you, both of you. So let's begin with our questions. And by the way, the readers of the Portland Tribune have contributed to some of these questions. Now, transportation is pretty much the hottest topic on Metro's dance card this year, what with a $5.2 billion, it's billion with a B, regional transportation measure on the November ballot. The measure includes funding for new projects in 17 transportation corridors in the region and a new light rail line between Portland and Southeast Washington County. So with that in mind, I'd like to start with transportation measures. Proponents say that this measure is a good idea because it will create jobs, because it's environmentally the right thing to do, it increases mass transit, and because Washington County is growing by leaps and bounds. Surprisingly, many of the opponents agree with all of that, but they say that because the economy tanked and because businesses and Oregonians are hurting so badly, the timing is just wrong. They also say that during the pandemic, ridership has plummeted. Let's start with this basic question. Is this the right time to be pushing a transportation measure? Mary Nolan, do you want to kick us off?
It's a complicated question, Dana, and it has lots of aspects. I am not on the council yet. I would have preferred some improvements to the process and the result of the measure, most notably fairness and equity of the funding mechanism, really much more significant impact on reducing greenhouse gases. The measure, as Metro has analyzed it, essentially holds us even, would spend $5 billion of local money and however much federal and state match we can achieve and not move the needle when we need to be moving the needle decidedly down. But the question in front of me as a voter and other voters is, are the good things that you've mentioned about this measure, the improvements in corridors serving large proportions of communities of color, the benefit of the youth pass to the entire metropolitan region for all high school students, the improvement in bus rapid transit lanes, do they outweigh the negatives? And I come down on the side that they do. And that with the delay of collection of the revenues for more than a year, Metro has effectively mitigated the concerns about the timing.
Chris Smith, what do you say about the timing of the measure?
So obviously none of us would like to be in a recession right now, but the truth is that we have been trying to shape this measure for the better part of two decades, and we have finally reached a broad consensus on the project list. And I'm impressed by that. And I think it's time to move forward, not only because the package itself, the measure is stimulative, it will create jobs, but not just the job creation. We know that transportation improvements also stimulate the economy in general because we make it easier for people to get to work, to school, to their daily activities. It's the economic lifeblood of the community. I also think it's important, and you know, Mary and I agree that youth paths, the projects and corridors are very important. We also agree that we prefer it did more for climate. But an important point is that this package was shaped by a BIPOC-led coalition, both the steering committee that formally put together the projects and then the Getting There Together coalition that advocated to improve the project list even further. This is the group of people that should be in charge of shaping this measure, and I think we should honor them by passing it. Thank you.
The transportation measure includes a payroll tax that has no sunset and which can be spent on anything after the transportation projects are funded. Chris Smith, let's stick with you for a minute. Do you support a sunset and or limits on the use of that payroll tax?
We've been asked this question in debates before, and I think we're both in agreement that this should not sunset. Well, let me say that we should not pick a sunset at the onset, right? The sun is just rising to get this work done. We could certainly have time to evaluate what needs to happen when we get to the end of the project list. So I don't want to direct what a future Metro Council should do 10 years from now.
Mary Nolan, same question to you. Does this need a sunset or do we need limits on its use?
As I understood it, Dana, two parts to your question, the sunset and restriction of use. I believe that because the measure produces funds for both capital investments, which are often bonded and often approved for just those projects and the duration of the construction and startup, but this one also has ongoing operating programs like the youth pass, like traffic safety in different corridors, like the Albina Vision program, and to sunset those when they are ongoing needs, I think would be short-sighted. If I'm on the council, I would make sure that we review progress on the entire package and each individual component, preferably semi-annually, but at least annually, and review at that time whether the funding mechanism should either be reduced because certain goals had already been met, or whether it should be sunsetted entirely. But I think it's too early now. If the voters approve that list of projects and that list of programs and operating improvements, I think it would be not fair to them if we undercut the ability to pay for the programs they supported. However, to your second point, I would be interested in and happy to restrict the use of those revenues to transportation improvements in the region.
Both of you at one time or another have pointed out that this project doesn't really address carbon. It's not going to reduce our footprint much. If voters say yes to it, and if one of the two of you then is on the board, is there a way that you could retroactively go back and start to fix that? And how? Mary Nolan, let's kick that off first, please.
Oh, I think there is a way, and I intend to do it. Metro has a climate policy that this package needs to contribute substantially to. The policy of reducing greenhouse gases significantly, 35%+, in a relatively short period of time, by the time this capital program would be completed. And I think Metro has to step up. The broad framework of the issues, because that is actually in front of the voters, has to be held with integrity, because we have to deliver to the voters what they wanted if, in fact, they approve it. But the way we deliver it, the design of the programs, the blending of the capital investments with congestion pricing to change drive-alone traffic patterns and reduce them to incentivize people to move out of single passenger cars and onto transit, to change TriMet so that that isn't a punishment for people, but something commuters and students and people going to leisure activities and shopping want to use TriMet. All of those are things we can still do if the voters approve this. And I am eager to get on that and start doing it immediately.
Chris Smith, if you're on the board and voters should pass this thing, are there ways that you could retroactively change the carbon footprint element of it?
There are two ways we could tackle that. One would be to adjust the project list itself. I think that's a dangerous path. We need to keep faith with the voters on the projects that they've seen and are voting on as part of this package. Doesn't mean we couldn't make adjustments, but we'd have to make sure we had broad community support to make those adjustments. And there are some projects that are primarily auto-oriented that if we can convince the community, I'd be happy to remove. But I think Mary points out the correct approach, which is that this has to be coupled with other policies. Since the beginning of my campaign, I've been advocating for congestion pricing as the key policy to deal with congestion in our region, and to take the revenue from congestion pricing and use that to vastly expand both the frequency and the breadth of our transit service so that more people can meet their daily needs with transit rather than having to get a drive-alone automobile.
I'm going to move away from transportation for a moment. Metro has greatly expanded its responsibility in recent years. It now includes parks, funding affordable housing, funding social services, and now possibly funding transportation projects. Supporters say that Metro is being dexterous and deft in responding to regional needs. Critics say it's mission creep and overreach. Let me start with you, Mary Nolan. Is Metro being flexible in changing with the area's needs, or is it in fact experiencing mission creep?
I think Metro is both responding to and leading on things that really do need regional solutions. And let's remember, several of these expansions have actually not been at Metro's initiative, but leaders in the community, leaders from the counties, leaders from the cities in this region have come to Metro, and citizen activists have all come to Metro and said, homelessness doesn't honor county lines. It doesn't stay neatly within city limits. The need for social services, the airshed, which is served by the Green Spaces and Habitat program, doesn't stay neatly within one local jurisdiction. These are regional needs, regional opportunities, and only a regional government can efficiently and effectively bring people together to address them. And frankly, only a regional government for some of those programs that require additional funding has the capacity to make sure that the funding of those programs that benefit the whole community is shared equitably among the counties, among the cities, throughout the region. And I think that's an important role for Metro to play. I don't see a lot of opportunity or need for Metro to expand beyond its current responsibilities. But one of the things I plan to bring to Metro Council is a focused emphasis on making sure Metro is delivering specific results, measurable, objective, and accountable and transparent to the voters.
Chris Smith, are we seeing mission creep in this organization, or is it simply being dexterous and changing with the times?
Well, let's review that list. You mentioned natural areas. That's something Metro has been doing for a long time. We've just recently passed our third natural areas bond measure to acquire and rehabilitate properties for either habitat or human recreation. That's not new. Transportation funding is not new. Metro was created to meet a statutory requirement to funnel transportation funds from the federal government. Yes, raising the revenue may be new, but that's, again, something I mentioned that has been on the table for more than a decade. When I served on TPAC at Metro more than 15 years ago, we were trying to figure out how to structure a regional investment measure in transportation. The new area is housing. The housing bond measure was part of a very deliberate strategy of regional investment. Our region's leaders recognized that we needed investment in natural areas, in housing, in transportation, and Metro stepped up. The relatively new idea was the supportive services measure, and that is exactly because the community came to Metro and said, we need to do this at a regional level. We can't do this community by community. Metro, can you please do this? Metro did not go looking for it, but I think they're going to ably administer it.
Chris, I'm going to stick with you for a second if we could. The Interstate Bridge Project between Oregon and Washington is an absolute mess, and it's been that way for years. You have called on the legislature to shift responsibility for highway planning in urban areas to regional planning organizations, such as Metro, and away from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Expound on that, please. How would that work?
Sure, thank you. ODOT has demonstrated over and over again that it does not know how to work in urban areas. It does a great job of connecting the cities in Oregon. That's its charter and mission. But as soon as we get inside urban areas, they propose things that are absolutely silly. The last iteration of the Columbia River crossing was 12 lanes. You know, we have real needs at that crossing. We need a more seismically resilient bridge. We need to get high capacity transit across the river. We need good bike peg connections. We should probably have an arterial lane to get to and from West Haddon Island so you don't have to get on the freeway to go get your groceries. What we don't need is more lanes. If we're serious about climate change, our criteria for any improvement project to that crossing has to be that vehicle miles traveled are reduced by the project because they're shifted to other modes. ODOT doesn't know how to do anything except add lanes. Metro is in a much better position to look at the needs of this region and craft a crossing that would make sense.
Mary Nolan, you obviously know ODOT from your time in the legislature. What are your thoughts on that proposal?
ODOT still comes from the perspective of an engineering perspective rather than a user's perspective. Methinks actually that sometimes ODOT is enchanted with the possibility of building the biggest public works project in the state's history, and that would be a nice little plum on some of the engineers' resumes. That shouldn't be the way we in a transparent and environment-friendly, climate-friendly, neighborhood-friendly way design our freeway systems. So I think what we need is some way to make changes in that perspective, changes in the directive to ODOT about what its responsibilities are. That's beginning to happen, but frankly, they seem to be a little deaf to public preferences, public testimony, and local leaders' requests. I opposed the expansion of the Columbia River Crossing, the building of the Columbia River Crossing, as it was described when I was in the legislature, in favor of expanding capacity through non-climate invasive, non-climate destroying methods. And I will continue to lead that way at Metro.
The zoo, the Oregon, the Oregon Convention Center, the Expo Center, they've been hit hard in the pandemic, the quarantine, the economic downturn. These were all money makers for Metro. The zoo in particular is Oregon's largest tourism attraction. Metro has undergone significant layoffs. Mary Nolan, if elected, how would you go about righting this ship? And is it time to consider selling off some of these venues that are hemorrhaging money?
Metro has already put in place some significant and painful measures to address the budgetary, the revenue shortfall at the venues, particularly at the Convention Center, the Performing Arts Center, P5, which, by the way, let's make sure we remember, Metro operates for the city, which owns the Performing Arts Center and those theaters, as well as the Expo Rec Center, which is at or very close to the end of its useful life for the purpose it was built. I also want to remember that the assets you're talking about, the spaces you're talking about, were purchased by, paid for by voters, and in particular, property taxpayers in the region, in the city. And I don't think selling them off for what I'm pretty sure will be a short term, I don't know exactly how short, but it will be a short-term bump in our economy. I think it would be really short-sighted to sell them off at bargain prices because, frankly, I think that's what you get for them now. Venues, convention centers, performing arts theaters are all struggling, and to try to sell them now would lose value that the property taxpayers have put into them. I think that would be a disservice to the people who wanted those facilities and will want them when the economy improves.
Chris, these former money makers are now hemorrhaging money. Is it time to think about selling them off?
Well, let's look at them one by one. The convention center is vital to our region's tourism industry. I don't know that there'd be much of a market for it, but certainly we want that back in place when people are traveling again. I guess if we reach the conclusion people were never going to travel again, we might make a choice about that, but I don't think that's going to happen. The Performing Arts Center, as Mary points out, is owned by the city. I think Metro probably has the option of handing the keys back to the city. That could be a debate we could have in the future with the city government. I think the one we should really be thinking about is the Expo Center. As Mary mentioned, it's at the end of its life, and there's a serious question of what its mission should be. You know, what's the best use of that property for public purposes? Should we reinvest and replace the buildings, which are now at the end of their life, and continue to have an expo center? Should we build housing there? Should we do other things that are in the public interest? Metro is conducting a conversation with the community right now to figure that out. I don't want to make any predeterminations about what the outcome of that should be. But I think we need to keep a range of options on the table and recognize that it's important both to the African-American community, to the Japanese community who were interred there during World War II, and to our indigenous communities for whom that's a traditional area. So we need to move carefully, but we should be taking a hard look.
The Cascade Policy Institute, an organization which I don't quote very often, has issued a report that says over the past 2 years, Metro's debt has quadrupled. They claim that Metro currently has more than $1 billion in debt. Is this report accurate? Does Metro have too much debt? And if so, what are their plans to bring it down? And Chris Smith, can we start with you?
So I don't know the exact debt figure, but I don't imagine that it's far off. Let's understand where that debt comes from. It's bonding for projects that the voters have approved. So, the voters have committed to property taxes to pay for the affordable housing bond measure. That's $600 million. They've committed to pay for the natural areas. So those are debts that are secured by taxes that the voters have voluntarily stepped up to. So no, I don't think it's too much debt. I think it's part of carrying out the mission that the voters have entrusted Metro with.
Mary Nolan, what do you think about the Cascade Policy Institute's latest claims about debt and Metro?
There was a time when I was aligned with John Charles, but it has long since passed. I haven't read the Cascade Institute's report, Dana. Thanks for calling it to my attention. I wouldn't be surprised if the number is close to what you've quoted, both because actually Cascade Policy Institute usually has its data right, even if its conclusions, I think, are misguided. And I think we need to consider that debt to be the equivalent of a mortgage. The voters have asked Metro to acquire green spaces, to acquire habitat, to build facilities in those green spaces and open spaces so that the public can enjoy the benefits of it and students can visit there to learn about nature in the city and to learn about how our ecosystem works. Metro has made those purchases and is paying for them through a mortgage. The funds are committed by the voters to pay for those over the duration of the bond measure. So it's no different than when you buy your first house and you're shocked at how much you'll pay over time, but you've acquired a real asset in the process. So I think it's reasonable. Metro has really tight financial controls and it has an internal auditor who makes sure that Metro doesn't step outside its capacity or its commitments to the voters. So I think if we look at it that way, it actually feels a lot more responsible.
I want to talk about density for a moment. Metro has been reluctant to move the urban growth boundary, that invisible circle around Portland and suburbs beyond which urban services like water and sewer are prohibited. It's moved it, but it's moved it incrementally in very small units. Meanwhile, newcomers flocked to Oregon. Between 2018 and 2019, Multnomah County added 8,500 people. Washington County grew by 7,000. Clackamas County increased by about 4,000. And that was nearly half of the state's entire growth. Given that, Chris Smith, let me start with you. Is it time to reconsider the slow expansion of the urban growth boundary around the metro area?
No, it's not. It's to the benefit of everyone in this region to keep the urban growth boundary tight. When we expand the urban growth boundary, we don't just create a windfall for the landowners that happen to have the land at the edge, we create expenses for the region. If we're going to serve new areas, we have to have water lines, sewer lines, roads that are expensive, particularly with housing. If we burden that new housing with those costs, it looks more expensive than housing that's already inside the urban growth boundary. Now, to make a tight urban growth boundary work, we do have to accommodate all those people who are coming here or being born here that you talked about. And the way to do that is to infill within the urban growth boundary. And I've been central to Portland's efforts to take more than their fair share of that growth with policies like our recent comprehensive plan update, where we expanded the size and locations for multifamily housing, and for projects like the residential infill project, where we say, where once you were only allowed by zoning to build a house for one family, you can now build a house, a duplex, a triplex, you can have an ADU. So we have room to accommodate more families in existing high opportunity neighborhoods. That's an equity achievement as well as keeping the urban growth boundary tight.
Mary Nolan, is it time to reconsider the glacial expansion of the urban growth boundary?
Well, it's time to reconsider the urban growth boundary, which Metro by law has to do every 4 or 5 years and will be doing during the term of whoever wins this seat. So there will be an opportunity to consider the urban growth boundary, urban reserves, and rural reserves. And I think it's important to mention all of them because the boundary has both an inside the boundary and an outside the boundary element to it. Inside the boundary is where urban growth, urban services, urban communities exist. Outside the boundary is where agricultural activities happen, where forestry activities happen, where natural resources are preserved, where habitat that cleanses the airshed for the entire region is most prominent. I think we need to think of it from both those aspects, the impact inside and the impact if we push out too fast or too far, what happens to those regional assets that help everybody. Metro has a deliberate process. It follows state land use law, which, as I pointed out in my opening remarks, I helped overhaul, so I'm very familiar with it. I will be deliberate in my participation in the urban growth boundary process, and I will listen to all considerations and make a decision that is true to our land use laws and honors the needs of the diverse communities within the metro region.
Thank you. We've been talking about policy. I'd like to talk about politics for a second. And I want you both to please take this next question in the spirit it is intended. This is a race featuring a long-serving, extremely wonkish, math-centric, policy-heavy political nerd versus, well, essentially the same person. You two have far more in common than most political foes. Given that, and let me start with Chris Smith, why should you get the voter's nod and not your opponent, given how similar you are?
Yeah, we do share a lot of experiences. For example, we've both had the experience of losing a city council race to Amanda Fritz. Amanda is endorsing me in this race for whatever that's worth. I think our approaches are a little bit different. Mary likes to portray herself as a convener. I think that's accurate, and she does a good job at it. I'm quite clear that I'm an advocate, particularly around the issue of climate. I'm coming to this role certainly to work in partnership with the rest of the council and the other stakeholders at Metro, but I'm there to be an advocate to make our region more climate friendly and to center that idea every day and move, if we're going to be wonky about it, the Overton window, that is the range of policy outcomes that are politically acceptable. I've got experience doing that. We did that with the Rose Quarter Freeway expansion. I lead the group No More Freeways, and we've gone from sort of everyone thinking, of course, we need to expand that as a bottleneck, to the community recognizing that it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So I want to continue that work, particularly around climate at Metro.
Mary Nolan, same question. Given how similar you two are, why should voters give you the nod?
I think we are not as similar as you portray us, Dana. I am accomplished with a long track record of delivering results. Chris seems to not value convening. In the public arena, I think convening and collaborating and finding a way to solve problems with people who disagree is the essence of what an elected Metro Councilor should be doing. That's the biggest difference, and I think it's pivotal because I've done it when I was Director of Environmental Services for the City of Portland and created a billion-dollar Clean River program that was created with environmentalists, advocates for ratepayers, industry, transportation, all kinds of groups and individuals with very competing interests. And we found a solution that became very successful, a national model, and works well. I think we need to do that kind of thing at Metro. I did it in the legislature time and time again, funding the Tillicum Crossing, updating the state land use laws, creating funding for affordable housing, raising the minimum wage. You have to be able to respect the people involved in the process enough so that they will work collectively with you, because tomorrow, the people you disagree with today may be on your side on an issue. Building those relationships is how you get things done.
You want to use your time?
So I certainly respect Mary's accomplishments in the legislature. But when we're talking about climate, I think we have to recognize that we have been failing for decades to address this. And it is going to take absolutely determined leadership to move us forward to the kind of world where we don't go beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming and big parts of the planet become uninhabitable. I'm focused on that. I've been focused on that in the Planning Commission. I certainly haven't alienated any of my colleagues. I know how to maintain relationships even when we disagree, but I move climate forward.
I'm going to stick with Chris Smith for a moment. In the voter's pamphlet, and again tonight, you wrote and said, quote, "Now is not the time for career politicians," end quote. But you've served on the Metro Transportation Policy Committee, the Metro Policy Advisory Committee, the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission, the Portland Streetcar Board. I grant you that these have not been elected positions, but it still sounds like the resume of a career politician. Expound, if you could, on your statement a bit. Why are you implying that your opponent's experience is a negative?
Really, it comes down to the way that we fund our campaigns. But you know, I would describe myself as a career policymaker. I have sought the opportunity to be part of policymaking processes, generally appointed, as you point out. But then the role I've taken is to be the inside advocate working with outside groups that are pushing for good policy. So working with Audubon to get better treatment of West Haden Island, working with Opal to get more equitable transportation policy. And I'm being very careful in this campaign to limit the influences that could potentially derail me in that mission. I'm only accepting contributions up to $500. I am not taking any PAC money. I want to be able to go to Metro as an independent voice who can advocate for the policies that I think are important.
Mary Nolan, do you want to respond to that?
And I want to direct this directly to you, Chris, because I've become increasingly disappointed in the way you're conducting your campaign. You blasted me last week for taking a contribution from a fracked gas pack, capital F, capital G, as if that were the name of the pack, of the donor. And you know that's blatantly and provably false. You vilified two local Black leaders who are supporting me, who each has built a business from scratch here in Portland that now provides family wage jobs and wages and benefits for over 50 employees each. Your surrogate showed up on your behalf at a community forum and essentially told the audience that I was too old to be a leader. Aside from the obvious pot kettle irony of that statement, the comment is deeply misogynistic. I'd like you to apologize right now to me, my donors who you've vilified, and voters in generally for stooping to run a negative campaign that doesn't sit well in Portland. That's not the kind of campaign Portlanders want.
I'm going to maintain the moderator's role of figuring out who speaks when and next. So if, Chris, you want to think about that, you may. Mary, Nolan, I have a question for you. And that's that I was talking to a number of people telling me you're running for this position, and I asked what they knew about you. And what they talked about was Planned Parenthood, Basic Rights Oregon, Oregon NARAL, Teatro Milagro, all those agencies of which you've been so important at such an advocate, but none of that falls squarely into Metro's bailiwick. And every time I told people you were running for Metro, they said, that seems like a funny job for her. It seems like an odd fit. Tell us why that is not an odd fit and why your background isn't somehow make this look like the wrong job.
Well, first of all, I'm glad that people recognize the leadership I provided to those organizations. Those causes are truly dear to my heart. They are part of who I am. But no more so than preservation and responsible development of the land that Oregon has within its boundaries. They don't know, perhaps, that I have been an active supporter, McCall Society member, and Tom McCall Award recipient from 1000 Friends of Oregon, the preeminent advocate for land use protections in the state of Oregon, directly in Metro's wheelhouse. They don't know that in the legislature, I championed innovative programs to reduce greenhouse gases, reduce mileage driven in private single passenger vehicles, pilot programs and expansion of those, directly again in Metro's wheelhouse. They may not know that I created funding, a new funding mechanism at the state level dedicated to affordable housing that tripled the amount of money the state was able to invest in addressing the needs of homeless Oregonians across the state. Those are directly in Metro's wheelhouse, plus my ability to convene people, solve problems, create respect, get people to stretch to do the right thing. That's exactly what Metro needs right now.
Chris, I was going to take this opportunity to ask you to talk about your experience and background. Although if you choose to talk about the question raised by Mary Nolan a minute ago, you should feel free to do either.
Sure. I think I've made the point that my work in land use and transportation planning is directly on point for what Metro does. So to take a moment to respond to Mary, you know, the company that made that contribution is a gas company. It uses frack gas, and they made the contribution through their PAC. So I don't know that any part of that statement is inaccurate. You know, I am concerned that our entire method of campaign finance leads to bad outcomes. And if some of your contributors, individuals or companies, are part of that, then yes, I think they're part of producing bad outcomes, but I don't personally criticize anyone for that choice. I'm criticizing the system. And I have only ever authorized a surrogate to one event. I don't believe you're present at the event, so I'm not aware of the incident that you're talking about. And certainly, I have no problems with your age. We are not that different in age. We're both baby boomers. I'm happy to acknowledge that.
Freedom of speech.
You want to take your
I want my 30
free speech
seconds.
Pass?
Chris, you're not owning up to what you're doing. We all make mistakes. We all do things in the heat of moment that we regret later. You're not acknowledging that this is coming from you, even though it's coming from your campaign. Let's be clear. I did receive a contribution from Northwest Natural Gas, who you might have noticed is one of the sponsors of this event tonight. Civic Minded has made investments in renewable natural gas, made investments in tightening its own system to reduce escaping gas. It is on the forefront of investing millions of dollars in exactly the thing you say you care about, and you dismiss them as if we can't work with someone because they're a big utility.
I think we're out of time.
I think that deserves the customers of Northwest Natural
Thank
Gas.
You.
It deserves the process.
Now, we're about ready to hear some questions from the audience. Participants have submitted questions in advance by emailing questions@pdxcityclub.org. We got a lot of very good questions to the audience. Here's the first one. I'm reading these off cheat sheet here. Transportation and land use planning are central to curbing our greenhouse gas emissions as a region. What are three things that you will do if elected to make meaningful progress on reducing emissions? Chris, you want to kick us off?
So two in the transportation sphere, developing an equitable region-wide congestion pricing system, then taking the revenue from that and using it to fund greatly increased transit service so that people have other choices than driving alone. And we need to absolutely continue our work on making our buildings more efficient. We used to always be in the top 10 list of cities with the most sustainable buildings, and we have this year fallen off that list. We need to renew our efforts and double down.
Mary Nolan, you want to take that question?
Whether the transportation measure in front of voters passes or not, I think it's important for Metro to find the funding to not just electrify TriMet's fleet of buses, but to electrify the buses serving all school districts within the Metro area. Whether those buses are owned by the school districts or owned by contractors, we can incentivize districts to insist that the vehicles used to transport our students are not spitting out diesel exhaust. That both benefits the health of the students riding on those buses and it benefits the atmosphere and reduces greenhouse gases. Improvements in the way we handle solid waste and recycling within the metro area and with the garbage that is exported from the metro area. And I'd agree with Chris on congestion pricing. Do it in a way that is fair, that supports low-income people, and makes the needle move on greenhouse gases.
Here's the next question from our audience, and it is, what is Metro's role in, and how do you envision the next steps, Portland's Superfund cleanup sites and redevelopment of the lower Willamette River? Mary Nolan?
I think Metro's role needs to be to lead by example. Metro owns property along the port in the Portland Harbor. Metro is a participant in the process. Metro needs to show the other responsible parties that it is long past time to be quarreling and quibbling about the solution. We all need to step up, take responsibility for the property we own and we're responsible for, and move forward to actually implementing instead of this constant debating, which is really just trying to play the clock down. Metro shouldn't be part of it. I will insist that we're not part of it. And I think we should also use our persuasion as well as any incentives we have to encourage other responsible parties to behave responsibly.
Chris?
I agree with everything that Mary just said. I'll go further to say that with respect to the Willamette Cove property, we have a responsibility to improve that and make it a jewel of the natural area system within Metro. That's a unique property. We don't get waterfront property open for new uses that often. It's also an important transportation link, be part of the North Portland Greenway. So Metro should go above and beyond what DEQ mandates, and it should improve that site so that we can make it fully usable to human beings. There shouldn't be fenced off contaminated areas. We should make the whole property usable for human recreation or other uses and really make it a jewel in our system.
Here's an interesting question that I would not have thought to ask. Will either of you advocate keeping the MAX trains or buses running as late as bars are open to reduce drunken driving? That's an interesting one. Chris, you want to take that one?
Yeah, the decision of how late into the evening to operate MAX is probably, or buses for that matter, probably better determined by the transit planners at Metro. Certainly the bar patron should be one factor in that, but I'm just as concerned about the shift worker who gets off at 2 a.m. as I am about the bar patron who stumbles out. So if we can find the demand that makes it make sense financially, we should run transit as late as possible. And TriMet has had night owl service in the past. There's a late night bus that goes to the airport that unfortunately was cut during the pandemic. I think it's coming back. So we should find the cases where it makes sense and do it.
Mary Nolan, you want to field that one?
I will advocate for making transit available, efficient, and frequent. I will also advocate and work collaboratively with the leaders at TriMet within Metro and around the region to redefine what that might mean. I don't know that it has to be X megaton train running on a fixed track to serve the need of shift workers, who I'm also concerned about, more concerned about than I am about people who are out being celebrating whatever they're celebrating. But I think there are other ways for TriMet to provide that service that are more efficient, more cost effective, and do the job really well, such as on-call services, maybe a van that works like a jitney used to work, picks up several people close by and delivers them to addresses close by. But certainly I will advocate for TriMet expanding service in terms of hours and frequency.
Here's a question that came from a listener just moments ago. Sometimes civic engagement looks like people with an agenda showing up to advocate. But is there a role for Metro in creating proactive engagement of the community on long-term decisions? How can Metro engage more of the community, and particularly people of color and low-income people who are least likely to come to the public meetings, in decision makings? Mary, do you want to kick that off?
I think Metro has done a good job of starting with that. Metro has a number of advisory groups. Chris has served on one. They collect information, they bring expertise and lived experience, they raise questions, they try to weigh and balance different perspectives on an issue, and then they make recommendations. the council with advice and analysis from the staff then goes and makes the final decision as the elected people who are directly accountable to the voters. I think there's plenty of room for more of that. In part, I think that means being really close to the places, the organizations, where people whose perspective, whose concerns, whose needs are not conventionally represented. Going out and meeting on their turf, on their terms, respecting their values, their processes, rather than make them conform to Metro's.
Chris, it's kind of a complicated question. Do you want to take a swing at it?
Absolutely, because I've had lots of experience with this, particularly on the Planning and Sustainability Commission. And just to correct the record, I've served on two advisory committees at Metro, both TPAC and MPAC. You know, the way we do public input is changing. Pandemic has changed it, right? We're now taking testimony over Zoom. That has pros and cons. I think once it's safe to meet in person again, we should take the best advantages of both in-person testimony and online testimony. So if you know, a mom out in Cully wants to testify at one of our hearings, but doesn't want to have to interrupt making dinner, you know, she can hop on Zoom and get a scheduled slot and testify to our commission. But if she wants to come down and talk to us face to face, she has that opportunity as well. We're all learning how to better engage BIPOC communities and other communities that have traditionally been underrepresented. I think Metro did a great job with the transportation measure. You know, we can pay people stipends to be on advisory committees if it's an economic burden. We can provide childcare at meetings. There are lots of things we can do to make it easier for people to participate.
It's a pretty good question. Metro is focused on the long-term game, the future of the area. Describe to us what is the best big advantage, big fix that you anticipate we will have by 2050? And what is the biggest problem that you anticipate we will not have fixed by the year 2050? Chris, why don't you start us off?
So by 2050, we're going to have to worry about rising temperatures. We're already seeing that. It affected us with the wildfires because rising temperatures dried out the fuel that helped drive those wildfires quickly and dangerously. But we're seeing it in the urban area as well. We have one of the largest urban heat island effects of any city in the country. So if you go from the leafy neighborhoods on the west side to tree-deprived neighborhoods on the east side, often near industrial neighborhoods, again, I'm thinking of a place like Cully, there's a 9-degree difference in the peak temperature during the day. And that's enough to affect human health. So we are all going to have to learn to deal with rising temperatures and hopefully plan so that we can mitigate particularly those disparities.
Mary Nolan, the biggest win by 2050, the biggest failure to address by 2050.
Because I'm working hard on it and I know that other people of goodwill are working hard on it, I think we will resolve the warming of the climate, the changing of the climate, the warming of the planet and the changing of the climate. There's technology, there needs to be political will. At the local level, I think there's political will. We need capacity, ingenuity, and grit to actually implement it. But I think we will. I also think we will, by 2050, we will right the injustice in our community and our nation. Particularly to Indigenous people whose land we stole, as we mentioned at the beginning of this, and to Black people who descended from enslaved people. On the side of pessimism, I am concerned that we are at risk of exacerbating the inequality of distribution of wealth between the generations. Chris and my generation have been taking for ourselves assets that are produced by the entire economy, and we are leaving younger people without, and I think we need to change it. I hope we can, but I am concerned that we might not have the will.
Here's a pretty good question just came in. It is Metro's job to implement the recent homeless services measure passed by voters. What is your experience with managing a major project like that? Mary Nolan?
A major public program. I have run two substantial 300 plus employee agencies for the city of Portland, designed programs from scratch using community input and technical expertise and financial expertise. In the legislature, I led efforts to expand The Oregon Health Plan, which serves much of the population that is now camping on our streets. And I have created coalitions and served on the steering committee of the Fair Shock Coalition, which has delivered housing reforms, wage justice reforms, and social services and mental health reforms.
Chris Smith, what's your experience running a major project like that?
Well, I'm going to quote Mary on this. And I do have a 30-year management career in our region's high-tech industry. But Mary has pointed out multiple times that on council, we are not managers. We are legislators and policymakers. And I think that applies exactly correctly in this situation. Our job is to set the policy, to set the goals, to hold the organization accountable to deliver those. We're not the project managers.
I'm going to head into the closing statements. Before I do, I want to make a
Dana, I'd like to use a free speech pass.
Do it.
I'm going to use this to rebut our sponsor. You know, I have spoken about the impact of fossil fuel money as part of this campaign and in general. Our sponsor showed us a slickly produced video of children and butterflies to make us feel good about them. That fossil fuel company is exploiting the Alberta tar sands. And if those tar sands are fully exploited, we will blow the carbon budget for the planet. So we have to watch where the fossil fuel money goes, because it's what's kept us from dealing with climate for 30 years.
Now it's time for the closing statements. We started the evening with Mary Nolan, so now we're going to begin with Chris Smith. Chris, please give us your closing statement.
Thank you, City Club, for having us. This past month, I joined a handful of youth climate advocates from Sunrise on the banks of the Willamette River at the Esplanade. Typically a postcard view, we were wearing masks, coughing, barely able to see downtown Portland. Many of these young people are half my age or less, but they were motivated to join a photo shoot because they intuitively understood the danger that the climate emergency represents to their present, let alone their future. Folks my age have a responsibility to not just listen to these brave youth climate advocates, but to act as though our house is on fire, because it is. I'm running for Metro because I'm sick of pollution. I fought carbon pollution long before it was hip or sexy. Over the last two decades, while my opponent was taking large donations from those frack gas packs, I was fighting freeway expansions, blocking a propane terminal, and fighting to preserve 800 acres of habitat on West Hayden Island. I'm also sick of the way that racism and white supremacy has polluted our society, especially our housing market. My time on the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission has taught me a lot about how our city and region can escape the legacy of racist housing policies and tackle our housing affordability crisis with an anti-racist lens. I'm proud of my accomplishments on the PSC, and I vow to support the movement for Black Lives by pushing to remove TriMet's armed security and supporting BIPOC leaders in our changing region. Our politics are polluted by money. We've all read Rob Davis's series. That's why I'm running a grassroots campaign. I've been pushing for campaign finance reform my entire career, starting with chairing a City Club research committee on the topic 20 years ago. I ask for your support for my grassroots campaign for a regional Green New Deal and my candidacy for Metro Council. Thank you.
Mary Nolan, can you give us your closing statement?
Thanks, Dana. Thanks, City Club, for this opportunity. And thanks to the listeners for tuning in with us this evening. For the last hour, I've made the case that my progressive values, generous instincts and actions, and open-mindedness ideally qualify me for Metro Council. As I wrap up, I want to highlight one vital talent and attribute I bring to Metro that my opponent doesn't. As the Northwest Examiner reported in endorsing me, her forte is turning aspirational goals into consistent policy. Having a vision, articulating urgent goals, and sweeping reforms to improve equity, preserve the climate, assure dignified housing for all, and foster a genuine sense of community are for naught without the skills and temperament to build coalitions, to pass ordinances, to establish standards, to provide funding, and to leverage that funding with local, state, federal, and philanthropic matches. My track record as Director of Environmental Services, State Representative, House Majority Leader, and CEO of Planned Parenthood Advocates shows my effectiveness and experience in convening diverse leaders and sincere advocates in solving complex, contentious problems on a grand scale, like what Metro has to do and gets to do. As we lift ourselves, our families, our community out of the pandemic and the wildfires and move boldly to end the racism that permeates too much of our national and local norms, Metro must bring this region together collaboratively and boldly. I'm ideally prepared to lead those efforts. I'm Mary Nolan, and I ask for your vote as Metro Councilor. Thanks.
That concludes today's debate. I want to say thank you to Mary Nolan and Chris Smith for being with us and for answering our questions and for seeking to serve our community in this elected position. We want to thank everyone running for office this year. For decades, the City Club of Portland has hosted debates, town halls, and forums, and has written countless position papers. The City Club has done a great service for Portlanders, for those who live in the Tri-County area, and for all Oregonians. Thank you for that, and thank you for this opportunity to moderate tonight's debate. We will be covering this race and all the local races at portlandtribune.com. Remember to vote November 3rd and vote the whole ballot. For the Portland Tribune and Pamplin Media Group, I'm Dana Haynes. Thank you.